This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program, and we have our panel of trumpet writers ready to discuss the important events of this amazing week that we've come through. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
A lot of big news to cover on today's program. We're going to start with the high volume of devastating earthquakes hitting around the world. And this is right at the same time as these massive hurricanes have come in from the Atlantic after Harvey and Irma. This past week, Puerto Rico was flattened by Hurricane Maria. But on Tuesday, Mexico suffered its second massive quake in 2 weeks. And this amid a number of major earthquakes in several nations. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as you said, on Tuesday, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake shook Mexico, toppled many buildings, and killed at least 224 people so far. That actually makes it, in terms of death toll, substantially more devastating than the previous big Mexican earthquake this month on September 7th, even though that September 7th earthquake was an order of magnitude bigger than this one. It was an 8.1 instead of a 7.1, but it also hit during a time of day when there weren't many people out and about. This one hit right during like the peak of the business day and the school day. And so while that first earthquake on September 7th killed about 90 people, this one's killed almost three times that, 224. So that is just really some devastating tragedies down there in Mexico between the two of these. That's over 300 people this month in earthquake and earthquake-related catastrophes.
I've actually read that there's quite a that death toll could go up quite a lot just because there's so many of these buildings that have been flattened that it's going to take them a long time to unearth get the rubble out of there and then to deal with how many they just don't know how many people are inside of these buildings. But the amazing thing is this happens amid a whole flurry of earthquakes that have taken place. September 22nd, there was a 5.5 in Mexico. September 20th, a 5.7 in Indonesia. September 20th, 5.9 in Papua New Guinea. And that same day, a 6.4 in Vanuatu, a 6.1 in Japan. September 19th, the same day as the Mexico quake in New Zealand, a 6.1. And just several more in the previous couple of days, Mexico, Chile, in the South Atlantic, Papua New Guinea, another one, 5.7. So there's a lot of seismic activity going on, much higher than what you would ordinarily see, and major destructive earthquakes taking place in several nations.
Right, and then combined, especially in that Gulf of Mexico area, areas like Mexico, the Caribbean, the United States, between that and the hurricanes, it's just been a really catastrophic month for natural disasters. They actually had another hurricane hit Puerto Rico that doesn't look like it'll hit mainland, but it was quite devastating there. And that's something, and as we've covered on this program several times before, a lot of people in the news media are trying to blame the hurricanes on climate change or global warming. So far, there haven't been too many people trying to blame the earthquakes on global warming. I've seen a couple who've tried to link that to something about like polar ice caps melting, which takes the weight off the top of the plate, even though I think most serious scientists realize that whatever ice cap activity is happening on the North Pole isn't actually affecting tectonic plates down in the tropics.
Right. So, but it does just immediately remind you of what Jesus Christ was talking about in Matthew 24, about there being earthquakes in diverse places, being a sign of the end of the age.
Right. It's a very specific prophecy. A lot of times when you're quoting about weather-related prophecies or God sending or allowing natural disasters as correction for sin, you do rely on a lot of Old Testament verses in Amos and in Leviticus and in Chronicles. But yeah, there is this really a very keynote prophecy right there at the in Matthew 24, where the disciples came to Christ and they actually asked him, because they were curious. They said, "Well, tell us, when shall these things be, and what's going to be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" And then when he answered, giving several signs, but very prominent among them being said, well, there will be famine and there will be pestilence and there will be earthquakes in diverse places. Mm-hmm. And so that's definitely something that's a very specific type of natural disaster that Christ himself called out, even more so in some ways than the storms, saying that, okay, in some of those storms, they cause pestilence and they cause famines. And there are verses in the Old Testament specifically about rain on one city and floods and whirlwinds, but this is right here in the New Testament with Jesus Christ saying that like an increase in just devastating earthquakes is going to be one of the signs that his disciples or his followers need to be watching for to know when his return is near.
You know, it's on a lot of people's minds as they're watching these things happen and one disaster following so hard on the heels of another and taking place in so many different areas. We do encourage you to go. We've been talking about this booklet a lot lately, but go to thetrumpet.com and look under the literature tab for that booklet on why natural disasters. It really does put all of these disasters in their biblical perspective and even answering questions like why God allows these to happen or where is God when you have these kinds of devastating events take place. It is really important to understand the biblical perspective on this, because otherwise it really does come across as just kind of a lot of senseless devastation and loss of life. But there really is a lot to study about this to understand God's perspective on it. So we appreciate that, Andrew. We're going to stick with you. We're going to move straight into some, well, earth-shaking speeches that were delivered at the United Nations this week, the first from U.S. President Donald Trump, the other from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For this first part, President Trump addressed the U.N. General Assembly for the first time, and he gave a speech that was, well, quite a bit different from what they're used to hearing there. For this, we'll stick with you, Andrew.
Right. Well, yeah, oftentimes during the previous presidential administration under Barack Obama, you'd hear his U.N. speeches, and they almost seemed like an apology for America's role in the world and how America needs to do things different or how America needs to do things better, and they've been a destabilizing force in the world in the past. And President Trump took a very different approach. He'd given this just a couple days after the 230th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution, so he really praised the Constitution. He really praised America's role in the world and did in some ways kind of set off a bit of a geopolitical earthquake. There was a lot of reactions from world leaders, some positive, more negative. I've brought a few of those where it said that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in his 30 years of experience, he'd never heard a bolder or more courageous speech. Though then Iran's foreign minister said Trump's ignorant hate speech belongs in medieval times. then you'll have others. Venezuela was very critical of it. North Korea was very critical of it. South Korea actually liked it quite a bit. They're the one key South Korean spokesman saying that he believed a firm and specific stance regarding important issues to maintaining peace and security were very important. And then Germany as well was on the team critical, being with the foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, accusing Trump of promoting national selfishness. He said his worldview describes the world as an arena, a kind of battlefield in which everyone is fighting against everyone else, in which everyone has to assert their own interests, either alone or in alliances of convenience. Apparently, he's taking the standpoint that Germany is very selfless in that regard and put the interest of other nations on equal par with the interest of their own people. And we'll see how he feels about that next week. But
well, it does. What was it about President Trump's speech that caused the consternation among Germany and some of these other nations? It's clear that he came after Iran pretty hard. He came after North Korea pretty hard, and he basically put these nations on notice that the United States was going to follow up and deal decisively with them if they continued their activities that were destabilizing the world.
Right. That is definitely why the more, I guess, what you'd call rogue regimes were critical of that speech, as he called out Iran for using oil money to finance Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations. He called out North Korea for starving millions of people to death. He called out Bashar al-Assad in Syria for using chemical weapons against his own people. He called out Cuba for supporting terrorism and said that he's not going to lift sanctions like President Obama had promised unless they change their behavior. He called out Venezuela for being a socialist dictator. Actually, surprisingly, he got applause over that, though. He said Venezuela's problem isn't that they've implemented socialism poorly. It's that they implemented socialism very well.
Right.
And I'm sure Venezuela didn't applaud that, but there were a few other world leaders who were more supportive of that statement.
Yeah.
But in terms of like Germany and Sweden, nations that you'd think would be a little more supportive of a speech saying that North Korea is a dictatorship, seems like that wouldn't be as controversial. But he did make a statement where he said, in foreign affairs, we are renewing this founding principle of sovereignty. Our government's first duty is to its people, our citizens, to serve their needs, to ensure their safety, to preserve their rights, to defend their values. As president of the United States, I'll always put America first, just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first. And that is a very realist observation, is mm-hmm. generally whether Sigmar Gabriel likes to admit it or not, Germany and every other nation in the world does what they think is in their national interest.
Right.
They may, like I said, especially like Germany and Sweden have come out and say, well, Trump, he's coming out like a nationalist and he wants to put America's interest first, and we should put the interest of all people on like an equal paring. He says that sounds nice, but you're lying through your eye teeth when you say that.
Right. Yeah, Jeremiah.
Yeah, Russia actually chimed in on this. Sergei Lavrov, their foreign minister, called Trump's speech a very welcome statement for that reason, because he appreciated what was realistic about it. And he said that the fact that the U.S., you know, Trump said America won't impose its way of life on others, mm-hmm. was a welcome statement. And Trump had mentioned mutual respect, which he also said was something we haven't heard from an American leader for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So he really welcomed a lot of those statements.
Yeah, it is. It seems like the way that he's talking about this, he did not, he criticized the United Nations, but he didn't say that international cooperation was a bad idea. And the idea of the United Nations, he praised quite highly. It seems like there was enough in that speech that pretty much anyone could have read into it whatever they wanted to, and focused on those bits that they liked or didn't like. If they were against Trump, they found plenty in there to criticize. If they liked him, then they found plenty in there to praise and to say, well, this was courageous and we welcome his realistic view and so on. But I do wonder what the effects of this might be, if this moves the needle at all on the way that other nations respond to the United States. You're talking about, say, the way that the Russian diplomat responded. And there were people in the United States, commentators, who basically said he gave Putin, Russia, the dictators of the world, freer hand to do what they want to do, basically saying, well, we're not going to interfere with your affairs. So this is giving license to tyranny. Or they took this as basically Donald Trump wants to start a nuclear war with North Korea. And at the same time, Donald Trump wants to allow Vladimir Putin to become even more dictatorial than he already is.
Right. He said a lot about like the sovereignty, like we need to support the national sovereignty of all peoples. And so he obviously criticized several dictators who he said were usurping the sovereignty from their people. He didn't talk so much about nations where the popular opinion is against human rights. But I think prophetically, the biggest story to come out of this, and it's not that this speech caused it, but this speech revealed a symptom of it, is just kind of like the messy divorce that the United States and the European Union are kind of going through. Surprisingly, he talked quite a bit about the Marshall Plan in this speech and how the United States' big role in rebuilding Europe after World War II, because both the Marshall Plan and the United Nations came out of World War II as kind of a way to promote, at least their stated goal, promote peace through the world. And throughout most of the past half century, United States and Europe have been very close allies. And now, especially since Trump's been elected, that is kind of something you've seen, to where the Germany and America have very different worldviews of where things should be going. The Trump administration standing a little bit more for nation, people should be sovereign over their nation. And Germany and the European Union supporting more of like these transnational movements, where you've got global organizations that lump nations into groups that they have to obey these like the things like the European Commission,
right,
or the United Nations, that is facing up to be a schism there, which is definitely foretold in the Bible, where it talks about that many verses throughout the Old Testament about the Assyria being the rod of God's anger, or about other send the Chaldeans and the Assyrians to invade the end time descendants of Israel. And for anyone who's followed this program for a number of times knows that if you look at the history and trace the national migrations, America is the descendants of end time Israel, Germany's the descendants of Assyria, and there's a war prophesied throughout Hosea and Isaiah and pretty much every major prophet of the Old Testament between those powers.
Yeah, Richard?
Yeah, I'd like to highlight a slightly different divide to Andrew. I think what another divide that the speech really exposed is between the liberals and the realists in terms of just your view of international relations. Germany, Angela Merkel didn't bother going. She's kind of, with the election on Sunday, she's got bigger, more immediate problems on her mind. So German's foreign minister Sigmar Gabriel was there, and he gave a speech on Thursday at the United Nations. And you know, Germany kind of leads the world in being the anti-Trump cheerleader. I think their media is more against Donald Trump than any media anywhere in the world. But he said, Sigmar Gabriel talked about his speech, and he said, "This worldview describes the world as an arena, a kind of battleground in which everyone is fighting against everyone else, and in which everyone has to assert their own interests, either alone or in alliances of convenience." You kind of read that and you think, well, yes, that's what the world is like.
Right.
That is the world. And that's what, you know, political realism has said the world is like for decades. But there are people like Sigmar Gabriel, and there are others that just try to believe that the world is a nice, happy place, and that nations will work together to get along in their mutual interest. And Donald Trump's speech is completely against that. And I think Europe is one of the places that's been able to have this illusion for so long, partly because they're genuinely able to get away with having this illusion. They've had the United States protecting them for a lot of their recent history. They don't really live in the real world from that aspect. And partly because they benefit from this illusion. They can kind of put forward their own agenda and pretend that they're not after their own self-interest, but they're actually just after the general good and benefit of all mankind. And I think there's a lot in Europe that don't actually, that do believe the world is the way Donald Trump talks about it, but talk very differently.
Right.
For the
Yeah, they're unaccustomed to hearing the blunt language, mm-hmm. But there is a certain underlying agreement. And that actually, I'd like to transition to a story from Brent. Those strong statements that President Trump made against Iran. He was talking about the ineffectiveness of the Iran nuclear deal, and obviously there were a lot of people who really criticized him for that. But the next day, the French president made some interesting comments that were at least consistent with what President Trump had said. For this, we'll go over to Brent.
Yeah, it was surprising. This is something that we're looking out for a lot. Not necessarily that we have a European leader agreeing with Mr. Trump to some respect, but a European leader that sees the danger and the threat of a rising Iran. We haven't really seen them be that vocal about that. And yet just this past week, as you said, after this speech, the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, came out and said, is the agreement enough? Talking about the nuclear deal that France was a part of, that Germany was a part of, that Britain was a part of, negotiating. He says, is this agreement enough? He says, no. It is not, given the evolution of the regional situation and increasing pressure that Iran is exerting on the region and given increased activity by Iran on the ballistic level since the accord. So he's saying, okay, it might have been a fair agreement had Iran lived up to it in the other areas that we thought they would, that they would become a part of the community of nations, that they would stop some of their development of ballistic weapons technology, that they would maybe put away and not be so vocal about their desire for a nuclear program. But as we've seen over the past year and a half now, or almost 2 years since the deal's been implemented, they have increased their march across the world. They've increased their ballistic missiles. Just today in Tehran, they had a new ballistic missile that can hit anywhere else, anywhere in the Middle East, on show for everybody. And this is what the French leader is worried about. And he said, well, we still want to keep the deal, but it needs to be fixed. And that's what Netanyahu has said. That's what even Trump has hinted at. If we can fix this deal, then it might be worth fixing it. But if we can't, then as Mr. Netanyahu said, we might have to nix it. So here we have a French leader standing by some of the comments of Mr. Trump, which kind of flies in the face of what we heard Andrew talking about just a second ago.
Yeah, it in some ways, Europe has to look at things realistically. And looking at the situation in Iran, no one can argue that that Iran is in a much stronger position than it was before that deal was struck. That the money that it has gained from that deal is being put toward Hezbollah, other terrorist activities. You can't refute those facts. They may couch things in fuzzier language than Donald Trump does, but to watch what Iran is doing and knowing, just looking at this from a standpoint of biblical prophecy, that Europe really is going to be fixated on trying to contain that threat, the growing threat that Iran faces. We were talking before we started to record the program about just how Europe is not particularly concerned about North Korea, that this war of words and the tensions, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, that's increasing between the United States and North Korea and within the Asian continent and North Korea, doesn't really affect Europe too much. But what the president, what Donald Trump is saying about Iran, that really does affect Europe. And Europe has a lot of concern about what's happening there. So to hear Macron, the French president, who is not necessarily known as a hawk by any stretch, he's more, moderate, middle of the road kind of European politician, saying these things about Iran shows, well, they really do see what's going on there. It's just a matter of at what point they would take stronger measures to try to contain it.
Right. That's exactly right. And it looks like, going on from those comments about the nuclear deal, that the French leader does want to get more involved in the Middle East. And it's kind of what we've seen a lot of through the past decade. We haven't really seen Germany take the lead too often. as far as European foreign affairs goes. Normally it's a French leader that says something, and that maybe some French troops that go somewhere, and then the Germans kind of follow on a little bit behind. Although they might be happy and with those movements of the French, they're a little bit off in the distance. And this is might be what we are seeing right now. He said, along with those comments about Iran, their ballistic missiles, he said, Macron also said, let's be honest. The tensions are on the rise. Look at the activities of Hezbollah and Iran's pressure on Syria. Mm-hmm. And that's the exact area that biblical prophecy says that Europe is going to become increasingly concerned with. Syria, Lebanon, this area that's on their doorstep, this area that if the Syrian civil war dies down and stops right now, you've got 6 million Syrians that are currently in nations, or I think it's about 4 million, sorry, Syrians that are currently in nations around Syria that are expected to return at some point into this new state. Are they going to return, or are they going to be continuously refugees? Are they going to want to go to Europe, realizing that they're stuck in these countries? And Macron sees this, and he says we need to work with the United States and possibly even Iran, mediating something here. They want to have another P5+1, and the French president said he wants to be in the middle of it to try and resolve what's going on, because of what Iran's doing. He's correctly labeling the problem, and that's what biblical prophecy says is going to happen. That the king of the south, as we see in Daniel 11 verse 40, is going to push at the king of the north. The king of the north being the European nations led by Germany. They'll see this king of the south, which is radical Islam led by Iran, and they will act against it. We haven't seen any acting against Iran or what they're doing in the Middle East from Europe, really. We've seen some in North Africa, but not yet in the Middle East. And now it looks like the French president is becoming vocal and telling the world that we do see it. And we do see that Iran is the instigator here behind it.
Yeah, if you want to get more information about that prophecy, go to thetrumpet.com and look under the literature tab for The King of the South. That booklet explains that prophecy in Daniel very thoroughly. And really, it's something that gives this whole conversation that we're hearing from the French president, puts that in its important prophetic context and why we would be looking at that so closely. We appreciate that, Brent. Before we come back to you about Netanyahu, I just wanted to follow up on the other situation that President Trump talked about in his UN speech, and that's what's happening in the North Korea situation. This war of words, I mean, he made some very strong statements against North Korea in that speech. The North Korean dictator, he came back with some pretty strong words against Donald Trump. And President Trump said he's going to set off economic sanctions against North Korea. This has all happened just in the last few days here. But behind the scenes, Russia is interfering with America's plan and undercutting those sanctions. This is a really important aspect to this story. We tend to focus on the activity and the words that are coming out of North Korea, but there is two very large Asian nations that are underwriting what's going on over there that we need to focus on. So for this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was one statement that Mr. Trump made during that speech. He said, it is an outrage that some nations would not only trade with such a regime, but would arm, supply, and financially support a country that imperils the world with nuclear conflict. No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. And so he didn't name any countries specifically there, but between the lines, it is pretty clearly pointing to China, which is North Korea's only treaty ally, with whom North Korea does about 90% of its trade, and then Russia, who is very quickly filling in some of the gaps that China's slight decrease in trade are leaving. And this coincides with a report that came out on Wednesday by Reuters showing that so far this year there have been at least 8 North Korean ships that departed from Russia full of diesel fuel. Their cargo was diesel fuel, and then they ended up going to their home country, to North Korea, despite declaring that they were headed to other destinations. So all 8 of these ships were at Vladivostok, which is on the far eastern Russian port there, or actually a couple of them were also at Nakhodka, a nearby Russian port, and each of them had between 500 and 2,000 tons of Russian diesel fuel. And then all eight of them registered either China or South Korea as their destination. That was when they filed their voyage details with the information system for state port control. But then shortly after leaving Russia, all eight of these ships headed to North Korea, to two different ports there. So changing a ship's destination once the vessel is mid-voyage is not illegal. But the fact that this happened so many times with these North Korean vessels leaving Russia shows that Russia and the North are really using this loophole to undermine all of those sanctions that President Trump and others in the UN are touting as being these really effective diplomatic measures. Back on September 11th, when the UN, including Russia and China, voted to impose that new round of sanctions on North Korea, so many just said, this is a big victory for diplomacy. But at thetrumpet.com, though, we pointed out that that latest round of sanctions was only passed after Russia and China had pressured the U.S. to water them down to the point where they were ultimately meaningless. The original proposal that President Trump wanted to slap on the North there was a total embargo on oil, and that would have really applied some serious pressure on the North. But then Russia and China forced him to basically, you know, weaken them and say, all we're going to do is cap that oil. And so that was what eventually passed. And then come to find out, even with that having been watered down, Russia is even going above that cap secretly by allowing these ships to go to North Korea. So it's a pretty sobering development there that shows that sanctions really will not bring about any sort of meaningful change.
So looking at the situation that, say, faces President Trump and anyone who is interested in trying to bring North Korea to heel, when you have a power as great as Russia that is underwriting what's happening in North Korea, China also heavily implicated in helping North Korea. How do you deal with this, and why is it so important that we recognize that? I mean, this is the real situation, that it's not just a battle against a little North Korean dictator. This is something closer to a war between great powers, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Russia and China are the powers that the world should really be concerned about, far more than North Korea, because it is Russia and China who really allow North Korea to operate so freely and to behave so dangerously. I've got a quote here from a coworker letter that Mr. Fleury wrote on September 13th. He said, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korean crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by Russia and China. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." Mm-hmm. And the prophecies that Mr. Fleury is referring to can be found in Ezekiel 38 and 39, also in Daniel 11, and Revelation chapters 9 and 16 especially. These passages show that it'll be Russia that leads an astoundingly powerful military bloc in the end time, with China in sort of a secondary position of leadership. And nations like North Korea will probably be assimilated into that bloc, but they won't be the main players in it. And Mr. Fleury has recently written a very powerful booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And in this booklet, he assembles all these scriptures and he explains just how it's happening and how Russia and China are really using the North Korean crisis as a bit of a distraction to exert their own will and influence on the world.
I think when you look at this whole situation from that standpoint that you were just talking about, and looking at the way that Bible prophecy labels all of the players who are involved in here and puts the emphasis where it should be, you really begin to recognize just how weak America's position really is. To this point, it really has been the exchange of words, and here President Trump is trying to impose economic sanctions, but the idea that, you know, how is he going to follow through with this threat to say, he said we're going to destroy North Korea if it continues this behavior, but he continues to focus on just this one individual. But what does he do about Russia blatantly, flagrantly violating efforts to try to bring Kim to heel? What does he do toward China? He really hasn't done much of anything. He's made a couple of statements that were somewhat vague, but he has to be pretty careful in the way that he handles those nations. But that really is where the focus needs to be. And in a way, it just shows you how America's will, even with someone as strong as Donald Trump is in the way that he talks about some of these things, really is a nation whose will has been broken. So that definitely fulfills another major Bible prophecy that we've been watching as well. Well, we're going to take a short break now. We will talk about Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech at the UN when we come back. We'll also talk about Germany's election on Sunday and some moves in Venezuela aimed at ending what it has called the tyranny of the dollar. We'll also talk about violent protests in St. Louis. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
All right, well, let's return to the drama at the United Nations. Another speech that made some waves at the conference this week was that by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. To learn about this, we will go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this speech has been kind of overshadowed, of course, by Mr. Trump's speech, and yet it really did. The fact that Mr. Netanyahu spoke after Mr. Trump, you could clearly see the wind in his sails, how positive and optimistic he was for Israel's future, and particularly for Israel's future in its relationship with other nations of the world. He started it off saying, "We are in the midst of a great revolution, a revolution in Israel's standing among the nations." And that's basically what he went through. Throughout his speech, talking about how in the past year there has been absolutely dramatic changes as far as how world leaders view Israel. He talked about, he said, quote, "I stood here last year on this podium and spoke about this profound change in Israel's standing in the world, and look at what's happened in the past year." He talked about all the foreign visitors that Israel's had. He talked about his visits as the first Prime Minister of Israel to Australia, first Prime Minister of Israel to Latin America. He talked about the first time that an Indian Prime Minister has come to Israel. He talked about Mr. Trump being the first American president to stand at the Western Wall. And then he talked about the six continents he's traveled to and just been welcomed with open arms to all of these. And then he said, after 70 years, that is, of Israel's existence, the world is embracing Israel and Israel is embracing the world. And then he even talked about the UN, talking about the fact that the UN, while it has been the seat of anti-Semitism for so many years, he even said that right to them. He said that he's confident that the revolution in Israel's ties with individual nations will ultimately be reflected here in this whole of nations. So it was surprisingly optimistic, extremely optimistic for an Israeli prime minister. When you look at Israel, beleaguered, just besieged by enemies, it seems, and yet he came out saying things are on the up and up.
So what do you make of this, Brent, this newfound optimism? It's clear to see where it came from in terms of its positioning right after Donald Trump's speech. But what do we make of this?
It is interesting, because had Mr. Trump not spoken, this has been would have been the speech that we were talking about. He was extremely strong on Iran. He pledged to the Ayatollah Khamenei, the dictator of Iran, as he called him. He said the light of Israel will never be extinguished. He was quite hard. He spoke directly to the Iranian people, saying, "We hear you, and we are not against you. We are just against your regime." And then he also talked about how the fact that Israel is threatened by Iran is resulting in a lot of friends in the Arab world coming to Israel, expressing their interest in having a brighter future with Israel. The Bahraini leader just said that he looks like he's going to have a diplomatic mission to Israel. President Sisi just met with him the night before his speech, the first time he's met with him face to face. And so he is looking around and seeing all this positive change. And there is positive change. He's not lying. There is a sense that these Middle Eastern nations especially are growing towards Israel's favor, or at least being very favorable towards Israel. In the Kurdistan capital of Erbil, just yesterday, there was somebody flying down the road with an Israeli flag out their window saying, long live Israel, because they support the state of Kurdistan. Hmm. So he's seeing all this and he's wondering, are we seeing a change that is going to last? Now, that's where we come in. And that's where we can understand through Bible prophecy whether this is a change that's going to last. And biblical prophecy is very clear that these alliances and these relationships, especially with the Arab states, the anti-Iranian Arab states, they're only temporary. They're only temporary. Mm-hmm. Even the second sentence of Mr. Netanyahu's speech, he said, the reason for the closeness of these nations, this is happening because so many countries around the world have finally woken up to what Israel can do for them. And that's true. They're all in it for what they can get from Israel. But the Bible indicates that there's coming a time, especially with these, some of these Arab states, that regardless of what they can get from Israel, they are in fact going to turn on the Jewish state.
Anything that you would direct people to get more information about that, putting it in context?
Yeah, there is one of these new trend articles that are up online at thetrumpet.com. There is a trend article entitled Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe. It doesn't necessarily mention Israel in the title there, but the reason for this alliance between the Arab nations, such as these moderate states, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the reason for their alliance is actually the destruction of Israel in the future. Mm-hmm. And you can read up about that in that trend article.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. This Sunday is a big day in Germany, Election Day. This is an election we've been watching very closely. One of the most interesting aspects of this election is the rising popularity of the Alternative for Deutschland party, a right-wing party that's been on the fringe, but it's expected to perform quite well in this election because of voters being attracted to its stance against immigration, among other things. The party's leader made some interesting comments earlier this month that give you an idea of where this party is coming from. For this story, we will go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Andreas Gauland is one of the founding members of the party. I think the party is still engaged in a bit of a leadership fight. So he's not the main leader, but he's certainly one of the very influential people in that party. And he said, if the French are rightly proud of their empire and the Britons of Nelson and Churchill, we have the right to be proud of the achievements of the German soldiers in two world wars. And that statement by itself is pretty shocking. This idea that a politician would come out and say, we have the right to be proud of what our soldiers did in World War II. I've never heard anything like that, I don't think, out of Germany. But then you consider this is the AfD. Current polls put them at about 12-13%. If they do that well on Sunday, that will be they'll be the third most popular party in Germany. And this quote, this statement doesn't seem to have hurt their popularity. I think some people kind of, when he said that, said, oh, well, the AfD, they've shot themselves in the foot now. Germans aren't going to want to vote for that kind of rhetoric. But, I mean, whether they're holding their nose and voting or whether they're agreeing and voting, they're still voting.
Yeah.
And that kind of rhetoric is not beyond the pale. But then what I think makes this really remarkable, or even more remarkable, is when you put it in the pattern of what we've seen just this year in terms of this intensification or this type of rhetoric, of just a complete change in how Germany deals with its past. So on Germany 17th, you had Bernhard Hucke, another important regional AfD leader, saying that Germany needs to be proud of its history, that it needs to make a 180-degree reversal on the politics of remembrance, on how it looks at the World War II period. He talked about how the Germans are the only people in the world to put a monument of shame in the heart of its capital, talking about the Holocaust Memorial. And all the while, the crowd is enthusiastically yelling, Deutschland, Deutschland. And that was an unprecedented speech. And we're way beyond that already. Then earlier this summer, we talked about this new book that was right at the top of Amazon's bestseller list in Germany called Finnish Germania. And this was basically saying the same thing that that Gauland was saying in his speech. He was saying, well, Britain and America, they've had things that are just as bad as the Holocaust in their past, yet they're still proud of their history. surely as Germans, we have a right to be just as proud of our history and as they are. And we need to stop fixating on this single time period of World War II. And we need to be proud now of what we've accomplished. And you talked about how Germans are the new Jews, that Germany is being unfairly victimized. So you're seeing a change in how Germany engages with its past. And it's a change that has very real world consequences. It's not something that's just of interest to, say, philosophers of how Germany views its past. The Council of Foreign Relations talks about, they had an article over the summer writing about how Germany may be escaping from two complexes that have long constrained its strategic thinking. They talked about how the first of these complexes is a psycho-historical complex which forces German leaders to bend over backwards to reassure foreigners about their intentions. Brent mentioned earlier the way any time you see Germany get involved in the international scene and send troops there, you know, it tends to not lead on that. It tends to go in there second. Often it will be France, say, that takes the lead, that sends its troops in first, and Germany follows on behind. And a big reason for this is of the way Germany engages with its past. That for a lot in Germany, military operations are unpopular because they have some shame for their past. But as that is changing, that attitude towards its military is changing. It's changing Germany's military role. And obviously this is something that we watch very closely, because this is something that's prophesied to change significantly in the future. Mm-hmm. One of the main prophecies that we come back to again and again on this program is that clash between the King of the South, or this Iranian-led radical Islam, and the King of the North, which is Europe, led by Germany. And that talks about Germany attacking the King of the South like a whirlwind, very quickly, very aggressively. And that requires a change to the Germany that we're seeing less and less, but certainly the Germany that we saw on occasions 5 years ago, say, where they just didn't want to, where the people didn't really want to get involved. Now we're seeing that changing. Now Germany's much more likely to use military force, much quicker to use military force. And so that's how you can see even this election tying into something like Daniel 11 and that clash building there. Is just, this is part of that ongoing process of military normalization within Germany.
Very good. There's a lot there to think about, a lot of ramifications. And if you want more information about this, go to thetrumpet.com. You can read Josue Michel's article, Germany Should Be, Quote, Proud of Its Accomplishments in World War II. And we're definitely going to be watching those elections on Sunday very closely. You mentioned just how you would have expected these statements to have hurt the AfD's prospects in that election, but we will see what happens. And we've certainly got a lot on the Trumpet site in anticipation of this election, and we'll have more coverage this coming week. So do keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com for that coverage. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We spoke a couple of weeks ago about China's efforts to undermine the dollar by creating a way for nations to buy oil futures without having to use dollars. This week, oil-producing Venezuela jumped on board with this effort in a big way. We'll just go through this story relatively quickly, and for this, we will go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this news broke on September 15th, and that was when Venezuela first began to publish prices for its oil in the Chinese yuan rather than in U.S. dollars, which are overwhelmingly used for quoting, settling, and pricing transactions in the global oil industry. And actually, 2 days before that, Venezuela had sort of quietly stated that it would stop receiving or sending payments in dollars. So the Venezuelan oil ministry published a statement about these moves, and it said, quote, "This is the result of the announcement made on September 7th by President Maduro that Venezuela will implement new strategies to free the country from the tyranny of the dollar," end quote. So Maduro had called for these strategies after America imposed financial sanctions on him and on some others in his socialist government just over their blatant disregard for the will of the Venezuelan people. And these sanctions ban certain financial dealings with Venezuela. They include blocking U.S. citizens from being able to buy new debt from Venezuela or from its state oil firm. So Maduro basically said, it's time we get free from the tyranny of the dollar. And then his oil ministry wasted no time taking these concrete steps to do that. And so most of Venezuela's crude is sold to the U.S. market. And because of that, and also since the nation's economy is too indebted to really engage in much petrodollar recycling, these moves by Venezuela alone probably wouldn't be able to diminish the power of the dollar. But Venezuela is not the only country that's trying to bypass the dollar in international trade. Back in 2012, Iran started letting China buy Iranian oil in yuan, the Chinese currency, rather than in dollars. And then in 2015, Russia did the same thing, allowing China to purchase Russia's oil in yuan. So there's been quite a lot of interest among these oil exporting countries to have an avenue to bypass the dollar. And then beginning in September, as you mentioned at the in the introduction there, news broke that China is very close to launching a crude oil futures contract that is priced in yuan and fully convertible into gold. So this this trend of oil exporters switching to the yuan was already getting some momentum. And now China, with this gold-backed option, is making it kind of a no-brainer, I think, for these countries to make the switch, just settling oil transactions in gold-backed yuan. So they'd be trading their chief export for something far more secure than U.S. dollars that are not backed by gold. So these countries like Venezuela and Russia and Iran, they also very often fall afoul of U.S. foreign policy, so they would also have a way to circumvent all those kind of sanctions like those that Maduro was talking about there. So at present, these measures are not really doing that much to weaken the dollar's status as the currency of oil sales, but as more and more countries start to jump on board with this sort of thing, it really could be disastrous for the dollar. And that's something that The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have been warning about for about 50 years now, just that there would be a financial crisis originating in America that would send shockwaves across the globe and end up restructuring the entire geopolitical landscape. There's a quote here from Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. In 1968, he said, "If the dollar is devalued, inflation will almost surely result in eventual economic collapse for the United States." And so his forecast about that was founded on Bible prophecies, such as those written in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And those prophecies very clearly state that if the modern descendants of ancient Israel, which is America and Britain, if they reject God, then he will bring devastating curses upon them. And so it's really quite a sobering development there. If more and more nations begin to make this switch, then it could very quickly lead to that collapse in the dollar that Mr. Fleury wrote about. And we have a booklet called He Was Right that chronicles many of the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong made during his ministry. And it shows that during the years since he died, back in 1986, they've either been fulfilled or the stage has been set for them to quickly come to pass. And one of those chapters in He Was Right is called Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied. And it goes into the details of Mr. Armstrong's prophecies about the U.S. dollar and the Bible scriptures that they were founded on. And it's I would just really encourage anyone who's not read that to go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there and just order a copy of He Was Right.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We have a very short, maybe a minute left for one last story. More violent protests in the U.S. after a race-related judicial ruling, this time in St. Louis. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this happened last Friday where they did an acquittal for a jury acquitted a white police officer who had been accused of unjustly shooting a black man back in 2011. And public opinion was at least among some sectors of St. Louis society, didn't agree with the jury acquittal. So you had many Black Lives Matter protests that started on Friday afternoon, started out peaceful during the day and turned very violent at night, and then violent the next night, and then violent the next night. And by the end of it, they had about 3 days of of rioting that resulted in about 120 arrests.
And we would send people to where in order to get more information about why this would be prophetically significant?
Probably the most comprehensive thing that you could do is our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a booklet released last year called Great Again on about the state of modern-day America. And one of the chapters in that book is called Where America's Race Riots Are Leading, that just really gives the background and the current event updates and the prophetic angle of why all this is happening.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can go to thetrumpet.com to read the stories and to get the literature that we talked about on the program today. You can also tell us what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with these words from Gerhard Coker. Believe me, the government will help you anytime it needs you. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.